Today, the government launches a coronavirus action plan. But is it enough? And with World Book Day tomorrow, what's it like to learn to read in your 20s?
When WHO uses the word pandemic, what they mean is that it has got out of control and is spreading across the entire world.
Our message continues to be that this virus has pandemic potential.
We're not quite there yet. What's happened is that we reached a tipping point when it took off in places that had no reason to take off, namely, really, Italy and Iran and South Korea as well. Before that, we were looking at places where there was a lot of movement of people from China into the country. And then suddenly, when you have a load of cases in northern Italy, that's when everybody gets very troubled. So we've had a lot of cases of people from Italy actually going to countries and starting small outbreaks there as well.
Several European countries have announced their first cases, all apparently linked to the outbreak in Italy. Austria, Croatia and Switzerland all report
Austria,
cases.
Austria, Switzerland, Spain and Greece. France today also confirming its second virus-related death.
On Tuesday, Latin America's first case of the virus was recorded in Brazil. Again, someone had just returned from Italy.
And it's happened in Algeria, in Nigeria as well. And the numbers have risen all over Europe. So France and Germany have both had outbreaks that are spreading. And in the US, there are now quite a lot of cases, and now they have deaths.
Today, health officials in Washington state announced 4 new deaths, bringing the total to 6, all in the Seattle area.
In Britain, not only have people come here, and we've now got quite a few cases, but actually somebody went from the UK to China and actually brought it back to China.
Yesterday, Boris Johnson published the government's coronavirus battle plan as the number of cases continue to increase, tipping the world towards a possible pandemic. The 28-page document warns that an escalating outbreak could result in 1 in 5 people being too sick to work, schools closing down, concerts cancelled, and the elderly being advised not to attend social gatherings. Plans could see police and fire services only respond to the most serious call-outs, the army brought in to help, and retired doctors back on duty. The scenarios range from a mild pandemic to a severe prolonged one, like experienced in 1918 with the Spanish flu. Johnson claimed,
"Our country remains extremely well prepared, as it has been since the outbreak began in Wuhan several months ago."
But is it? From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, preparing for a coronavirus pandemic. This has been raging for some time now. So while there is still a lot that we don't understand, there are things that we know. We know that COVID-19, as it's called, can be very serious with fatalities, but that in 80% of cases, it's mild. We know it comes with a cough, a fever and shortness of breath. But despite Googling obsessively about this, it's actually hard to find very many first-person accounts about what it's like to have it. I mean, there's one from 21-year-old Tiger Wee on the Guardian website that says, "The aching muscles, fatigue and fever feel like going to hell and back." And then there's another man who contracted COVID-19 on that cruise ship who said, "It's not that bad."
Yes, I think for most people, it's very like the sorts of things that we have all the time. It's just like cold or flu.
Sarah Bosley is The Guardian's health editor.
So 4 out of 5 people are only going to get it mildly, and it will just seem very normal in a way, normal sort of winter illness. But of course, for the other 20%, it's going to be very nasty and they'll be in hospital.
And while there are just a few dozen known cases in the UK currently, a leaked government memo suggests that 4 out of 5 of us could get it. How contagious is it?
When they talk about transmission, they talk about the RO number, and that is the number of people each infected person will infect in turn. And they have been talking about something like 2.5. That's the best estimate from China. If you look at that, you could get say 60% of the population infected if people don't take precautions. But of course, everybody's going to. So it's pretty unlikely we'll get there. However, when governments do plans for epidemics, that's what they do. They have to go over the top. They have to make preparations beyond, way beyond what we would expect to happen. So when we talk about mild symptoms, some people are actually going to be asymptomatic, which means that you've got the virus, but you're not going to know that you've got the virus. We don't know enough about it at this point to calculate how many people that might be or what the effect would be, the domino effect, if you like, of the population. You know, how many people will get infected in that way? This is all guesswork.
I do think the figures can feel quite confusing. I mean, I had heard a 2% death rate. That's 20 times seasonal flu. But now reports suggest closer to 1%, 10 times flu. What are we basing the data on?
Chinese scientists have done one big study that everybody keeps referring to, and it included something like 45,000 of the first people who actually got this in China, obviously in Hubei province and particularly in Wuhan. In that sample, the death rate was about 2%, 2.4, I think, from memory. But you've got to remember that they were only counting in the severe cases. They were looking at the people who went to hospital, and those were the people who were severely ill.
So basically, way, way, way more people might have coronavirus than we know.
Yes, that's right.
And it feels like there's a lot of talk about who is most vulnerable. I mean, what is the truth of it? There's a suggestion that men are more likely to die than women, and there's a suggestion that children are hardly getting this at all.
It looks as though the reason that men are more likely to die is because, again, we're extrapolating from China, and men smoke a lot in China. So their lungs are damaged in the first place, and very few women smoke. It's quite strange about children. They definitely don't get it as much. Something like only 2% of the cases are children. There is some reason, but again, it's one of the big unknowns as yet. The people who are most vulnerable are the oldest people and those people who've got weakened immune systems because of health conditions that make people really less resistant, shall we say, and their immune systems will find it harder to fight this virus off.
It does feel now like we're experiencing a bit of a step change, that people are worrying more than they had done previously, and governments are focusing first on how to limit the spread. This week, I've heard an academic suggest people shouldn't shake hands. The French are suggesting people should no longer do the double kiss. Do we know how it actually spreads?
We know some of the ways in which it spreads, and there is speculation that there may be other ways as well. So it definitely spreads in droplets, and that is from somebody coughing on someone else. So you get a water droplet laden with virus that's going from one person to another. Now, you need actually to be within at least 2 metres of the person for that to happen.
And it's not just coughs and sneezes we have to be wary of.
If there's a surface that's got virus all over it, table or a book that somebody's been holding or something like that, and you pick it up, if the virus is on that surface and you touch that surface, it could transfer to your hands. If you put your hands to your face, then it can get into you. It doesn't hurt if it's on your hands, but if it goes into your nose or mouth or eyes, then it's quite likely that you will contract the infection.
So it's not alarmist for the French to ease off on their traditional greeting and for us to ease off on a British handshake?
No, I think that's absolutely sensible. But you have to bear in mind at the moment that actually very few people have got it. So it's not a big risk shaking hands. But we may well get to that point, yes.
As well as how you might greet someone, the Health Secretary, Matt Hancock, has suggested that we should all wash our hands.
For 20 seconds or more, we're telling children that you've got to wash your hands whilst you sing Happy Birthday to make sure that gets through very simply.
Although I've just read that Jacob Rees-Mogg suggested maybe we should sing the national anthem instead. Now, at first, people kind of mock this, thinking, is that the best advice they can give us when we're facing a crisis? But is hand washing really effective?
Yes, hand washing is absolutely the best possible thing you can do. The more often you can wash your hands, the better.
You knew I was going to say this, but wash our hands with soap and hot water.
Antibacterial gels are also a help. Not quite as good as washing hands, but they're pretty good.
And what about face masks?
Face masks are great if you are sick yourself or you think you might be. If you wear a mask, you are protecting everybody else.
Other people. If there's someone in your family who is sick, you also need to put on a mask.
However, wearing a face mask, if you're perfectly well, won't help you.
If you have to take it out, you have to discard it. Do not reuse. If you
can. So really, it's one-way traffic with a face mask.
One of the biggest things the government has been doing is focusing on people who've come in from abroad, either asking people to self-isolate for 14 days from some places or to self-isolate if they've got symptoms in other cases. All of this must be pretty nerve-wracking for health workers. I mean, they really are on the front line. I mean, I know someone this weekend who was tested for coronavirus. And although they were given a face mask in the hospital car park, the nurses were not protected. How worried are they?
I think the health workers are probably fairly stoical about this. They have to come into contact with diseases all the time, and including infectious diseases. You know, you could go in there with flu and cough all over them. So it's not very different.
If you are calling because you are concerned about the coronavirus outbreak, please press 1.
Those people who do come in, certainly to hospitals, will be directed actually to a booth outside where they can phone 111. So they're not, hopefully, going to go into the hospital and endanger other people.
If you have a general question about the coronavirus, press 3 to be transferred to the Public Health England helpline.
The government has been holding emergency COBRA meetings about this. And yesterday, the Prime Minister Boris Johnson launched
the Coronavirus Action Plan.
What is it?
It's basically what we're going to do in the event that things get much worse than they are now. So it's got four phases.
Contain, delay, research, mitigate.
Where we are now, they call containment, which is just obviously trying to reduce the number of new cases we get. Then there's delay.
In terms of moving from containment to delay, there will come a point, potentially, and not definitely, where the amount of transmission is so great that actually the idea of containing, which is to say essentially getting rid of this virus completely, ceases to make sense.
And research, which is really ongoing. That's everything we're doing to explore possible drugs, work towards a vaccine, and also to find out more about the virus. But the key thing that is new is the mitigation strategy. Now, that is based largely on the contingency plans for epidemic flu that we've had in the past.
You can think of it as roughly 2 to 3 months from an outbreak of sustained person-to-person transmission, 2 to 3 months up to the peak, and 2 to 3 months after the peak to decline again.
And what it really means is that the government will take measures to ensure, for instance, that they can close down public events if they need to, you know, mass gatherings. That's happened in some countries already. Italy cancelled football matches, and in Paris, the art gallery, famous art gallery, the Louvre, shut, which was their decision, actually.
Coming up on the Channel 4 Morning Buzz, will the coronavirus have a chilling effect on the Summer Olympics in Japan?
Okay, so it seems obvious, doesn't it, that a major public event might be something that you might want to consider not doing to try and limit the spread of risk. But what about the things that are happening all the time, like children going to school or all of us coming to work?
I think schools generally should be okay. At the moment, the advice is they shouldn't close. And children are much less affected by this than adults. So they're more likely to make the class sizes bigger in case the teachers are actually sick. On the health service is going to be very hard pressed.
We will make sure the NHS gets all the support it needs to continue their brilliant response to the virus so far.
They're going to allow the registration of retired health professionals like doctors so that they can come in and help out. And they're also going to ask for volunteers to help in public services. So they're thinking of people being sick and the workforce being depleted, obviously. And the border force staff will be given extra powers, rather like the police. So they could potentially detain somebody who arrived with obvious symptoms of the virus but refused to go into self-quarantine, for instance.
We could have the problem of health workers falling sick, but also there is just going to be a huge additional strain on the health service if this gets out of control. Is the NHS ready?
No, I don't think it is. They have been preparing for flu pandemics for a very long time. All the same, when these sorts of things hit, they get absolutely swamped. So I think they're going to have a lot of difficulty. They'd have to free up extra beds, probably by sending home those people who are not very sick, and they will also cancel elective operations. So those are the ones that are not urgent. So people will have to wait longer for their normal treatment.
The Prime Minister stressed that all of this is not what the government will do, but what they could do if necessary. And interestingly, Chris Whitty, the Chief Medical Officer, suggested that they wouldn't want to roll this out too soon and force restrictions on individuals for too long. He said they'd wait until the right time to deal with the peak of the outbreak.
And the question is, at what time to implement which measures? What we really want to do is to implement whatever's necessary at the time, depending on how the epidemic goes, at the right time over a 12-week period or so is probably what's going to be needed to do it. So we don't want to go too early.
So that's the immediate stuff. But they're thinking of more extreme ideas, aren't they?
Matt Hancock has actually said that he would think about locking down cities completely. And that is absolutely taken from the Chinese example, which is said to have been pretty successful, actually.
China, of course, isolated entire cities. Is it conceivable under any circumstance you try and cut off a city in this country?
Well, there's clearly a huge economic and social downside to that. But we don't take anything off the table at this stage because you've got to make sure that you have all of the tools available if that is what's necessary. But
let's talk about China. I mean, there has been a lot of criticism about their early failure to be honest about what was happening. But as you say, they did a lot after that. What did they do?
The Chinese locked down their cities. Wuhan was the first example. And then after that, Hubei province. They built extra hospitals. They brought in teams of volunteer doctors from all over China. They equipped their hospitals with the latest machines. They all had to pull together on this for the sake of everybody else, for the community. And it does seem to have had an effect.
What does a lockdown actually mean?
The lockdown meant that nobody who lived in Wuhan, for instance, could actually go out of Wuhan. They shut down all the public transport and people were told to stay indoors. They were allowed out, I think, at specific times of the day to go and get provisions. But otherwise, people were cooped up in their homes, so effectively self-isolating for quite a long time.
And has that been effective?
Yes, it does seem to have been effective in terms of bringing the numbers down. The World Health Organization the other day showed a graph that indicated that the epidemic curve took a downturn as a result of these lockdown measures. Where you would have expected cases to carry on soaring, they didn't. And not only did it help China by reducing the cases, but actually it has postponed the spread to the rest of the world.
The identification of the pathogen was a record time, but not only that, the pathogen was sequenced and the genome was shared immediately so that other countries can use it.
China is one thing. It's got a very, very different culture to a lot of Western countries across the world. I mean, if we got to a place here where they try to lock down London, for example, or towns where we've had cases testing positive, do you think Britain would struggle with that culturally?
I think Britain would struggle. I think we're very individualistic. We don't have that sense of collective responsibility, perhaps, that the Chinese have, and we certainly don't have the tolerance of draconian measures implemented by governments. So it's very hard to see how that would work. And in a way, it might have to be voluntary in the UK. That means that you can't have a complete lockdown.
And of course, it is very different for different individuals. I mean, you talk about people self-isolating at the moment. That's fine if your company's happy to continue paying for it. I mean, I had a friend who had to self-isolate last week and lost money because they couldn't go to work.
Yes, that's very hard. I don't know what was happening in China, whether people were in any way recompensed, but it will be difficult if people are going to lose money.
The supermarket Ocado says it's experiencing an increase in customer demand. The BBC understands that this might be because of customers stocking up in case of any fallout from the virus.
This is clearly being taken more seriously than anything we've seen in recent years. I mean, British supermarkets have drawn up Feed the Nation contingency plans to cope with panic buying. They're saying that they could scale back on the variety of food available to focus on staple products. It sounds almost like wartime.
Be prepared, but officials are saying to not get carried away and stockpile on items such as masks and hand sanitizer, as we've seen.
I think people will stockpile, and that's probably a human instinct as much as anything else.
And for all of this, it's hard when you're talking about health to think about a cost-benefit analysis. But from the reports we've heard coming out of COBRA meetings, there is certainly a kind of discussion going on about the trade-offs, about what you could do to stop the spread and about what the economic impact of that would be. I mean, there was even one quote in the newspaper suggesting they had wondered whether it would be better to just let it come because the economic cost would be so high. I mean, what do we know about those type of conversations?
I would be very surprised if anybody was thinking about just letting this epidemic rage, because frankly, that is going to lead to deaths, far more deaths than are necessary, I think. And the hospitals will be overwhelmed and everybody will be in a panic. So any mitigation measures that we can take have to be a good idea. I suppose people could have those sorts of conversations in closed rooms, just, you know, on the basis of a sort of what if we tried that, what would be the consequence? But I'd be very, very surprised if anybody went down that route.
But it is a huge economic hit to carry out some of these measures.
Yes, but the entire world is suffering a huge economic hit at the moment. There's talk of the Chinese economy dropping by 2% in the first quarter of this year as a result of what they've done. And I'm sure it won't be any different for anywhere else.
These are the pictures coming in and the statistics too. It was trading more than 3% down in the closing minutes. Earlier, Paris, London and Frankfurt all ended the day around 2% lower.
Let's go. Sarah, you've been health editor of The Guardian for 20 years. You've covered a lot of outbreaks, including pandemics. You've travelled to the heart of them to see what is happening. I mean, two things here. How does this compare? And what, as we sit here in March 2020, are the best and worst case scenarios for coronavirus?
This is really scary because of all the unknowns. We just don't have enough information yet about how it's going to spread and how it will affect people in countries like the UK and the USA, in other words, outside of China. Really, all the information we've got is from these thousands and thousands of people who've been infected and many of whom have died in China. So it's a very different scenario. Our hospitals are probably in a better position, certainly than those in Wuhan when the whole thing took off. Yes, it is alarming, certainly because it's a respiratory disease that we know is going to be mild in most people, you know, as in 4 out of 5 people. It's less worrying for those of us who are healthy. But we do really, really have to worry about all the fragile people in our society. And so the measures that we take personally, I think, have to be with them in mind. And you know, we have to protect them as much as we possibly can.
So the worry about contracting coronavirus is really about the worry of allowing it to spread. But if, as you say, the symptoms can be so mild that you wouldn't even think to get medical help, how can they contain it? And if they fail to contain it, what's the next step?
I don't honestly think anybody thinks it can be contained anymore. There was a phase when they thought maybe we can contain it, maybe it'll just spread to a handful of countries, maybe it'll just be a handful of cases in each of those countries, and we can trace all the contacts and somehow stamp it out. But this virus, because it spreads through droplets and apparently really much easier than most viruses, is really quite problematic. Eventually, it's going to burn out because there won't be enough people left who haven't had it for the virus to carry on passing from person to person, because people will be immune. And we should have a vaccine, hopefully.
In how long?
It's going to take 18 months. So that's how long we've got to contain this for. That's how long we've got to protect our people for.
Sarah, thank you very much.
Very welcome.
That was Sarah Bosley, The Guardian's health editor. We're covering this story across the world and here in Britain with our health, science and political teams. There's also a rolling live blog. Do follow all the coverage on the website. If you're worried about having symptoms that you think could be coronavirus, or you want more information about places that you've travelled to, then do go online for more information, 111.nhs.uk. Coming up, life's everyday challenges when you're unable to read. Now, tomorrow marks World Book Day, and while that might make you feel guilty about a last-minute scramble for a fancy dress costume for the kids, have you ever thought about what it might be like if you couldn't read at all? Sarah Todd from Wiltshire is heavily dyslexic and managed to slip through the cracks at school without learning to read. Her difficulty led to stress, anxiety, bitterness, and isolation before she decided that something had to change.
Imagine being in the pub with your friends and they ask you what you want to eat and you freeze. You look at the menu and all you see is shapes and it makes you panic because you don't know what it says. This is what it's like every day when you can't read. I first noticed a problem at primary school when everyone else would read and I really, really didn't know how to pronounce anything and it really upset me. Going through school, I would just be scraping through with my writing, which I was not very good at because I was only writing the way I thought it was spelt in my head. Once I left school, not being able to read made it harder for me to make friends, get a job, keep a job, and stay happy. One of the jobs I had, I worked in a cafe. Now, you would need to read the back of the card to know what you needed to put on the plate, but all of the time I kept on saying to the lady next to me, "What's this? What's this?" And she would look at me and say, "Can't you read?" They'd end up sticking me out the back, washing up all the time. But then if you're out the back and you're using chemicals for washing up, there's certain chemicals you can use with gloves and certain chemicals you have to use without. And I didn't know which is which. And most of the time I'd come out with either burns on my hands or my skin would go flaky where I was using the wrong products. I felt very isolated. I felt like no one understood me. No one knew how I felt. I was aged 25. I had moved into my first flat on my own with my twin daughters. The girls would come to me and say, "Mummy, read, mummy, read." And I'd go, "No, let's turn the TV on. Oh, look, there's some toys. Let's get the Play-Doh out." I'd avoid it at all costs. It was awful. And I mean, the letters I was receiving, it got to the point where they were simple letters and then letters were turning red because obviously I'm in trouble. And my dad would come round and he'd read them and go, "Oh, Sarah, you're in so much trouble." It got to a point where something had to change. I had to be able to help myself, to help the girls, to keep us safe. And I had to make that change. I learnt to read twice a week, one-on-one, starting from learning your phonics. So learning how to pronounce words and taking it from literally baby steps up to slowly reading sentences. After 2 years of classes, I went to a pub with some friends and they all sat around reading the menu and my friend Linton said, "Would you like me to help you?" And I said, "No, because I'm going to have the burger with the blue cheese and the fries." And they all just sat there in silence and looked at me and I said, "Oh, what did I do?" And they went, "You just read out loud." And I went, "Oh yeah, so I did." And they all clapped their hands at me and I was like, this feels a bit surreal.
That was Sarah Todd, who learned to read with Read Easy. If you or someone you know would like to learn to read or to teach someone else, go to readeasy.co.uk. That's it for today. My thanks to Sarah Bosley and Sarah Todd. This episode was produced by Chika Ayres and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cucoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.